Hello, and welcome to another episode of Philosophy Exchange, where we continue our series of artificial intelligence. I'm Carl, and with me today is Rose and Demetra. Our discussion today will be on the topic of ethics and AI. We will begin by considering one, why some are concerned about AI systems, two, what the current approach to AI ethics is from a theoretical and practical viewpoint, and three, how virtue theory might contribute to AI ethics. Some of us, including yourself, Demetra, are asking the question, are AI systems helping or hindering us? There's been a focus on the harmful effect of AI, including biased decision-making and the possible, quote, superintelligence of AI. But more recently, the discussion has also been framed in terms of trade-offs, in the sense of gains and losses from AI. How should we make these decisions of trade-offs? This is a fundamental ethical query in both the theoretical and practical domain. Now, turning to the question, why are we worried about AI systems? Rose and Demetra, maybe we can begin by thinking about, okay, what some of these concerns are.
What you said, Carl, is really on point. Like there is, I think we sometimes miss the more insidious effects of AI systems. I mean, when you think about it, what they really are is just like cognitive outsourcing applications. So instead of doing some of the thinking for yourself, you'll get an AI system to do it. So one of the most obvious examples that I'm sure a lot of students will be familiar with is Grammarly, which is supposedly an AI platform where you can check your grammar. And so instead of thinking through where you should put a comma or if you should use a hyphen or an N dash or an M dash or whatever, Grammarly will hint you towards the appropriate grammar that you should be using in your philosophy papers, for instance. Now, to me, that doesn't seem that harmful, right? There doesn't seem to be that many harmful effects from this. Maybe, someone who's really obsessed with grammar, probably some of my professors might wince when they hear me saying this. But I don't think it's so bad. But there might be other instances of outsourcing to an AI system, which we do think are pretty problematic. So, for instance, there are these examples of messaging apps which can, through like the application of an AI-based technology, they can learn your messaging style. So one example of this is an app called Bro App, and another one's called Romantomatic. So what they do is they learn your messaging style, how you communicate, and then you can use these apps to communicate with your romantic partners, right? So
Come on.
Bro App, it was these two apps were highlighted by a philosopher called Evan Selinger, who he actually did an interview with the founders of Bro App, and they said that the purpose of this app was so that a user could spend, quote, more time with their bros and less time maintaining their relationships with their partners. Now, I
Gosh.
don't know, I'd love to hear your opinion on whether you think this might be helping or hindering said user from cultivating their relationships with others.
I mean, intuitively, immediately when you say something like this, I get like, I think it's horrible, you know? Yeah, I guess the authenticity is out of the question in this way. So if a person uses this app, the person doesn't actually have the connection. It's the AI or the algorithm doing it, like creating a relationship. It's not the person anymore creating a relationship. You're giving kind of part of yourself to a device. And in this way, the device itself is trying to create a relationship for you. In some weird way, I think relationships are, yeah, it's necessary to have human to human contact in relationships. But maybe this argument doesn't really hold because now if you look at dating apps like Hinge or anything like that, it's not really human to human because either way, there's an interface between it. So yeah, maybe more and more the world is becoming more like this, what's it called, like romantic app. Yeah, I think actually for me, it's really the authenticity that's out of the question, the connection between humans. Because even in Hinge or on Tinder or something like this, still the human is typing it and using their brain and responding to, a joke or, yeah, there's more emotion involved, I feel, than whether like a device is just making a relationship for you. It just, for me, intuitively, it feels very wrong.
Yeah, I would just add to that and say it also feels wrong to me, this idea of a bro app. And I mean, perhaps, like, I haven't used the app, so perhaps I would be able to keep in touch with more of my bros if I use such an app. But
Actually, my supervisor, so I use this example in a paper I've just written this term as part of my master's degree. And my supervisor, when he first, when we were first discussing this idea, he thought, I probably explained it badly, he thought that the apps were to help you keep connected to your bros. And so he was really sad. Every time we talked about it, we were kind of laughing with each other because we'd say, oh, it's so sad that it could be used for quite a good purpose, but it just seems like, and I think, Rose, what you were saying is, we now get down to the crux of the matter, which is that it seems like outsourcing that act, the communicative act of maintaining a relationship with your partner, that seems to be intrinsically valuable. And it seems like these apps are obviating from that task, and they don't allow us to do something which would actually help us as individuals.
Yeah, it would be a kind of a learning experience for yourself as well, that you are outsourcing to something else. Maintaining a relationship, having human contact, I think is also beneficial for yourself in a selfish, egotistical manner maybe, but I think it helps you grow and evolve in this life and have the most optimal or Aristotle virtuous life.
Yeah, it seems like what I think the creators of this app are missing or are not taking into consideration is that the app doesn't necessarily have 100% some benefits for the user. They think that what they're doing is giving a user a platform to do more with their life. Right. But they seem to be overlooking the fact that they could actually be harming the user without the user realizing. So that
same time.
At
the same time, I was thinking, I agree with that. But say I'm a person that, you know, I don't actually want a relationship. I don't feel like having a romantic relationship. But yeah, I might, like, at least I might want to, but it's not my priority. It's maybe priority number 10 in my life. And number one is, I don't know, having the time to evolve creatively. Then second would be learn math, like a math skill, or I don't know. You have 10 different other priorities. Then this app will actually help me flourish because it will give me more time to work on the other 10 priorities I have in my life. And then the least of my priorities is maintaining relationships. So in this way, I am still evolving myself, growing, but and this app is helping me do that in a way because I'm getting more time to actually work on my priorities.
Carl, what do you think? You're looking very pensive. The listeners can't see the looks on our faces, but I can see that you're looking pensive about this.
I was just laughing a little bit thinking this is also like a mathematician would also put their priority as like the mathematics as like number one or two in their life. I apologize to my sister who is a mathematician, and I imagine that she does prioritize her relationship. People do have like different priorities and, you know, they go about it in different ways. So I think, Rose, like, you're right in the sense that there are trade-offs here where, you know, for some people, one might look at an app like this and say, oh, it's valuable in the sense that I can attain a greater overall kind of utility or value in my life because here is this kind of this object, this relationship aspect to my life that I would like to include. And without this app, then there would be no opportunity for me kind of to include it. On the other hand, there are those who will say, actually, one is going about one's priorities in the wrong way, where a relationship is intrinsic to the kind of human nature. And so the way that you go about it is you ought to kind of prioritize kind of your cultivation of human flourishing, so to speak. And the relationship is kind of essential to that. So if you cannot do that as part of your priorities number one and two, then you ought to consider kind of reprioritizing. Now, this is like, I think a really intense question, like how does one want to go about like the priorities in one's life. And actually, like, I think we'll get to this later on with Dimitra, your commentary on virtue theory as well.
Because it essentially it's the assumption you make of what is a good life. That's crucial in this which is a difficult question to answer in one episode. I think
it'd be great if we had an answer to that. How about I float another example with you and see how you feel about this one? This is slightly more extreme, more on the extreme side, but it is a hypothetical example. So this, what I'm about to say, doesn't exist. But two ethicists, I believe they're both from Oxford, called Gubelini and Salabascu, have published a paper in 2018 where they suggest that one application of new emerging AI technologies could be to create what they call an artificial moral advisor. And what this, they call it AMA. Maybe I'll just, for sake of being clear, just call it the full name. So the Artificial Moral Advisor. What they suggest that this does is, I imagine, I mean, they don't say exactly in the paper like how they imagine it manifesting in our life, but just imagine it being on your smartphone or something. Every time you have to make a moral decision in your life, for instance, which charity to donate to, which restaurant to dine in because you want to be vegan and you don't want to harm the environment, and you've got all of these considerations going around in your mind, you know, loads of considerations that actually on a day-to-day basis, we as kind of flawed moral reasoners might not be able to take them all into considerations. But nevertheless, we want to do the right thing. We want to do the moral thing. I think this is quite an intuitive thought. So Gubelini and Salabascu say, well, here's an idea. Why don't we just use this artificial moral advisor? Every time we have to make one of these decisions, we defer our judgment to the artificial moral advisor, and it tells us what the best outcome should be. So it crunches all the numbers. Think about it as doing like moral maths. And it would take all of your preferences into consideration. So going back to what we were just talking about a minute ago, of that we all have different conceptions of the good life. Well, that's fine, because all three of us, you know, what I think is my conception of the good life will be different to Carl's, it will be different to Rose's, but it's fine because the artificial and moral advisor will take all of this into account. And then the other thing they say is also it could take into account your friends and families as well. So say the three of us were going out to dinner, then through the clouds, you know, like imagine it working with our current technologies, through cloud-based technologies, it can tap into your artificial moral advisory system. And so I make a decision that's great because it's inclusive of yours as well. Anyway, this is a long explanation, but I hope you get the picture of like what this thing is. How does that chime with your intuitions? What do you think about that? Would that be good, or is there like something problematic about this?
I mean, it reminds me of this magic ball that people sometimes use that you have to shake, you know, that makes every decision for you. You shake it and it says, if I ask, is it a good idea to go outside? I'll shake it and it'll say not today or something like this. It reminds me of like a very advanced version of this magic ball in a certain way. I mean, it would be super nice if I wouldn't have to think about every decision I had to make in my life and that someone would do it for me, and actually in a good way as well. I think it's cool. I think I would get super, super lazy. So, and that I think my brain capacity would become less, because these decisions is what kind of triggers your brain every day. Like, should I exactly buy this vegetarian burger or not? I mean, there's a whole theory behind it, right? So, and you're the ones that are responsible for it. So every day you're confronted with these kind of moral questions and moral reasoning. So in that way, it's, I think it's necessary for humans to think more and to educate themselves on it.
So all of these things that we've been talking about, what I've been researching recently is whether these quite nuanced, difficult concepts, these problems that we're facing, whether they are addressed in the current AI ethics frameworks. And I think we should preface this part of the conversation by saying that there are myriads AI ethics principles out there at the moment. So there are like philosophers and ethicists who are drawing up what they think the right principles should be. But there's also people working in industry, you know, like for the big technology companies, and there's people who are working for international bodies, as governments. I mean, these AI ethics principles aren't a one-stop shop. They're being created by lots of different people for lots of different purposes. And for that reason, it also gets very difficult to talk about principles as one, because they all sort of do different things, or they're serving different purposes. But one thing is for sure, that is the current approach to AI ethics seems to be this principle-based approach, whereby you lay out certain, it's often a word or two, you know, AI should be used for good, or it shouldn't be used for bad, or it should be transparent, or it should, you know, promote justice. But when I was looking into whether these principle-based frameworks would help in the kind of insidious harms that AI might do to us, I kind of felt like I don't know if they address those problems, because as we've already found in this discussion, everyone has different conceptions of the good life. Also, it could be that an AI system is doing good for you. It's helping you to communicate with your partners, you know, with Bro App. Maybe you don't have much time, maybe you're working really hard, and it actually would be really helpful if you had this aid. But at the same time, there seems to be something wrong with it. And so I argued in my most recent paper that I don't think the principle-based approaches are sufficient to deal with these kind of cases. But again, I'd be really interested to see what your thoughts are on this.
Yeah. Because I was wondering, why don't you think it's enough? Because you call it, I've read your paper, and you call these principle approaches thin concepts. So you'd rather, you know, thicken it up. But what would you thicken it up by?
Okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so in my paper, I used Bertrand Williams's concept of thick versus thin principles. And the way he distinguishes them is that a thin concept is just it's merely evaluative. So it will say whether something's good or bad, but it won't tell you why it's good or bad. And a thick concept, on the other hand, is something that's both evaluative and descriptive. So it will tell you why it's good or bad, but also it will tell you, it will tell you it's good or bad, but also it will tell you why it's good or bad. So for instance, consider honesty. When you say someone's honest, you're kind of saying, this person is a good person, but they're a good person because of these reasons, that they don't tell lies, and they're quite transparent and forthcoming with their information, right? So
like Philosophy Exchange podcast.
Right. So then I thought, well, if you look at quite a lot of these AI ethics principles that exist today, they do literally say stuff like an AI system should be beneficent and it should be non-maleficent, which in non-jargon terms means it should be good or bad, right? And there are some philosophers who say stuff like AI should be put to good use. But what does that mean? It doesn't really tell you what it means. And one of the current, in the academic circles, a lot of people liken AI ethics principles to the principles of biomedical ethics, which have had a lot of success, as far as I know. I'm sure there are people who critique them as well, but in the medical sphere, and they are these four principles, which, to be fair, do say stuff like beneficence and non-maleficence, justice and autonomy. Those are the four core principles of biomedical ethics. But if you read the author's book, so the seminal book on the principles of biomedical ethics was published by Tom Beauchamp and James Childress, and I read their book, and the most recent edition was published in 2018, and it's sort of, you know, it's like at least 300-400 words of underpinning their principles with ethics, with ethical theory, with everything from virtue theory to deontology, virtue theory, rules as justice theory, rights theory, so it's like, okay, yeah, they're thin, but they're actually sort of thickened up. There's a thickening agent in their approach, which is ethical theory. And I didn't think, or I don't think, that we have the same, like, comparably systematic approach yet in AI ethics.
That's interesting. Mm. Yeah, just coming from, like, the industry point of view. So I, for example, am now working on facial recognition principles. So I'm working on a policy paper in which there are about, I don't know, 6-7 sections. And it says just 20 principles, it will say the data we are using for, I mean, that we store because of facial recognition devices, what do we do with them? We want to make it transparent. So for example, something like this is a principle, right? And I see what you're coming from, that it would be so nice to kind of have a descriptive factor within that, even, you know, maybe 200, 300 words underneath it saying, okay, what do we mean with transparent? Why do we want to do that? Which ethical point of view are you coming from? Nevertheless, I see in practice that not a lot of people have enough time to kind of delve into that and really read all these papers on ethics and different types of ethics. In practice, you know, that doesn't really happen. And then, so that's number one. I think that's something that we could definitely improve on. And, you know, we make time, we'll get more people on board. We'll get some philosophers on board. I think it's essential exactly to make these concepts more thick because they're so contradictory in the world, especially something like facial recognition devices is unbelievably contradictory in every sense. So I think it is crucial to really delve deep into the descriptive factor of these principles. Nevertheless, what I kind of am skeptical about is, say we do describe it and we come from it from an ethical point of view and we write, you know, 200, 300 words on why data storage should be transparent to the public, then which values are we going to implement? Are we going to implement the Western point of view? Mm. Are we implementing the Asian point of view? I mean, my question is then, which standpoint do you take and how do you kind of justify that, right? I think that's also the very big question that we see every day.
Well, I think you're completely right, Rose. There is no view from nowhere. I think that's Thomas Nagel's term, but I read his paper very long ago, so I don't know. I'm sure he would have something to say about this. but essentially, we are, every decision we make, every ethical framework that we come up with is value laden with our biases. And it's a huge problem. And with something, if we are going to create approaches that are global or should have global reach, then we face this real difficulty of how do we take into account multiple perspectives, multiple conceptions of right and wrong, justice, yeah, etc. It seems like there is a real problem. Luckily, I didn't have to face this much in my paper. So, but it also means I don't have a good answer to it right now.
Well, we don't have to have an answer to it, but I think also, yeah, I mean, it's a huge question, but I think actually the most valuable would be to be very explicit in which values you use, because you can never be value neutral, I believe. So if you use a value, then kind of state, you know, I'm coming from this from a Western perspective. This is my background. I don't know, be explicit and be aware of which values you're using. Yes. What do you think, Carl?
Yes.
I see you like thinking, leaning back in your chair.
Yes. No, I think the picture that I'm getting just from this conversation as well is that AI ethics is not something that can be simply kind of solved by a number of yes, no questions in the computer code, but rather is, you know, an extension of the questions that we as humans are asking about the values that we wish for ourselves. You know, an extension of that is, you know, should kind of human kind of values come first, this idea of anthropocentrism, or in some circumstances should kind of the values of animals kind of be raised, or the values of just non-human entities. For example, you know, corporations in the world in some circumstances hold a greater value than humans in certain countries, just on the basis that, yeah, there's a different value system there. So I won't name kind of countries here to give an example, but I just want to make the point that these questions that we're discussing here are not ones that we will answer in a singular kind of podcast episode. Mm. But I think we're emphasizing the point that there is serious discussion that ought to be had and deserves merit in these kind of ways, these places in our life.
What we could take into account when we talk about these principles, right, how to thicken it up, is actually by law, right, to adhere to law. So even if we think about, you know, say the data storage has to be transparent to the public, you know, what are we storing and things like that. A lot of my colleagues would say, at least, that what are we talking about all these ethical frameworks for? We should just be talking about laws, like what is allowed and right. what isn't allowed at this point, right? It's like, well, why are we talking about all this ethical yeah. stuff? Yeah.
I think the thing is, and this is kind of going beyond my remit as a philosophy student, but this whole area of new technologies is not currently regulated, at least to the degree that it should be. By a lot of people's standards anyway. Like, we have, you know, like data protection regulation, but we don't have, I don't think, a sufficient regulatory framework yet to deal with these new technologies. And how can we, to a certain extent, because the technologies are changing all the time, they're constantly evolving. And I'm not a law student. I have to preference everything I'm saying with that. I haven't taken a single law module in my whole time as a student, but I do know that it seems like we should be wary. We should be critical of the fact that companies who currently are not regulated in their use of these technologies are in effect self-regulating by publishing principles and saying, oh, here are our principles and we're abiding by them, so we don't need regulation at the moment. I mean, we should really be questioning why they're doing that, and if their principles are sufficient to actually guide ethical use of technologies, or rather if we should be regulating or figuring out a way at least to try and regulate them. Yeah, it seems like, to summarize, companies are using these principles as a way to say that we don't need regulation just yet, and maybe because they don't want the regulation.
Yeah, and then perhaps these ethical, you know, the principles, and then underneath it, the thicker concept of the ethical framework would actually be a nice kind of, how do you say this, like advice to get these a legal framework, right? It could be kind of the basis of a legal framework. And yeah, right. I think therefore it is essential as a starting point.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, philosophy and law are, you know, linked in so many ways. Like, legal concepts are ultimately philosophical concepts when it comes down to it. So absolutely. Yeah, that would be how I would say it is the best, like, route forward. Yeah. Mm. Mm.
So thinking then on virtue ethics, if we try and apply this thick notion of, you know, a principle-based approach to AI, I suppose your idea in your paper is to use a virtue-based approach to help with analyzing kind of the efficacy of AI systems by drawing on kind of ancient ideas of what it means to live well and flourish, and then consider what that might look like. Do you want to describe a little bit more kind of what your approach might be and how this might help with some of the conundrums that we've been discussing here today?
Sure, sure. Yes. Yeah, so my approach was to use virtue theory as like the thickening agent for the principles. So I don't make the claim that we should just get rid of this principle-based approach, because there is certainly some use to principles in that they tend to encode quite difficult and wide-ranging theoretical concepts into actionable principles that we can use and are useful. So but my point was just that let's thicken it up with ethical theory. Why don't we look at an ethical theory that's not seen as much application in this debate? And actually, virtue theory is, of the three main ethical theories, utilitarianism, deontology, and virtue theory, it's lesser applied, you know, in practical frameworks than the other two. So I just thought it would be interesting to see how it might speak to this debate. And kind of the framework that I drew was, well, it's Aristotelian. So I was reading the Nicomachean Ethics a lot over the last few weeks. And this is not to say that that's the only approach. So there are like Confucian ethics, virtue ethics, and also Buddhist virtue ethics. But just for the sake of time, I just looked at virtue theory from the Aristotelian canon. And I was kind of drawing on, well, what does it mean to live a virtuous life? It means that one should be motivated to live a virtuous life. So virtues are kind of ideal states. This is what Aristotle thought anyway. And to attain virtuousness is to attain living a flourishing life. So you're fulfilled in your life if you're a good person, essentially. And it's obviously more complicated than that, but I won't recount the whole of the Nicomachean Ethics here. And so I thought, well, okay, if we're thinking about AI systems as essentially cognitive outsourcing systems, then it seems like maybe they're detracting, they're taking away, or maybe they're getting in the way of our motivation to do good. So for instance, with the artificial moral advisor, are we really motivated to do good? Are we really reaping the rewards of those good acts in the virtuous sense? Like, are we becoming virtuous agents with the artificial moral advisor or with Bro app or with Romantomatic messaging apps? Or in outsourcing those acts to an AI system, are we actually not getting anything? And we're not really growing as moral, social, creative beings. And so this is what I was kind of, the framework that I was using to analyze AI systems. I guess I used it in a way to say, well, we can better understand what it means for an AI system to do good or to do bad by using this framework to analyze them. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And it's, I read your paper, and then part of it, one of the criteria that you kind of use from Aristotle of virtue theory, so is that an individual must choose the acts and choose them for their own sake. So a person will be in terms of what Aristotle would say, a person would be virtuous by choosing an act for their own sake. And then if we look at the moral agent, or what do we call it, the advisor, you know, we can already kind of analyze this by saying, if this moral advisor would choose for us all these acts, then in that sense, I can never be completely virtuous in the Aristotelian sense. And in that way, perhaps then this moral advisor is not doing good for us as humans. And so that's a really cool and interesting application that you made there in your paper, I think. And that's just one of them, but you have loads of different ones.
Yeah, it was a really fun paper to write. And I, the listeners, if they're interested in this sort of thing, I would definitely encourage them to explore this area because it is kind of underdeveloped. I felt like I was making a lot of stuff up in my paper, which was kind of scary, but at the same time, sort of, I guess that's kind of the feeling you want when you're writing a paper. Yeah, so it was really fun. And also, virtue theory has been developed a lot. So in the 20th century, that you saw a kind of resurgence of philosophers being interested in virtue theory. But it still is sort of, I think in all areas, not just in technology ethics, but sort of in environmental ethics and business ethics, there is definitely scope to interpret virtue theory and to apply it in this area. So it will be a fun future project for anyone wanting to work in these areas.
Yes, Demetra, I think that your commentary on virtue theory is, I think, first of all, helpful in the sense that there hasn't been sufficient discussion into alternative modes of ethics in artificial intelligence. Even just the first step of developing principles on which the AI decisions are based is necessary and important. But beyond that, to apply kind of well-described and kind of older, well-developed theories like virtue theory, deontology, utilitarianism, whatever it might be, I think that is a really helpful contribution to AI ethics and indeed to help resolve some of the problems and questions that we discussed.
Yeah, thank you so much, everyone. And hope you have a great day. And I hope you really liked to listen to this episode. And we'll see you in a month's time when we release the next episode. Thank you so much.